Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 61, One Heartbeat Away. This episode of Futures in Biotech is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/biotech.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there going to be the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy or something?
Ballpark, 10 years.
It's potentially one of the things that'll end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun is the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare it to our closest evolutionary relative.
Well, welcome to Futures in Biotech. This is Mark Pelletier speaking, and we've got a really experimental show today. One of the topics I've been avoiding is the biotechnology of the heart. There's been incredible amounts of advancement in our understanding of the human heart and our ability to fix it, you know, with drugs, through pharmacology, through genetics, through surgery. And, you know, we're one heartbeat away from death. And that scares me. So I've avoided doing any cardiovascular or heart biotech shows for a long time. And since we're approaching our fourth year anniversary, which is on June 14th, I thought maybe it's about time we tackle the hard stuff. And this is going to be a hardcore biotech show. I've brought on a young professor. His name's Julian Stelzer. He's a brand new professor at the assistant professor in physiology and biophysics at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. Welcome, Julian.
Hey, Mark. Nice to be here with you.
I had this idea, and he's doing it on very, very short notice. I had the idea that, well, you know, Julian's one of the smartest guys I know. And I thought, well, if he could come and explain a little bit of the biotech around, some of his field, basically get us introduced into his field. Then perhaps we could do some follow-up shows throughout the summer and really get a handle, of this. I'm going to read, so he picked two papers, but I'm just going to read the first little paragraph here of one of the papers, because it describes really the statistics and the importance of this work, right? It says heart failure. This is a paper by Shen et al. And it came out last week in Circulation Heart Failure, which is one of the top journals in the field of cardiovascular research. And it says heart failure, the common end stage of most forms of heart disease, afflicted 2.5% of the U.S. population. That's 2.7 million people in 2006. It was the cause of death for almost 300,000 people in 2005. 300,000 people, that's 100 September 11th. No, that's it's an enormous amount of people. And it says the NHLBI, which is the National Institute for Lung... help me out, Julian.
Heart, Lung, and Blood.
Okay, National Institute for Heart, Lung, and Blood. Framingham study has shown that 80% of men and 70% of women with heart failure under the age of 65 die within 8 years. So the total estimate... the total estimated cost for heart failure in 2009 is $37 billion, right? So this is, isn't heart disease the number one killer?
I believe it is, yeah.
So heart disease kills, what, 1 in 5? Cancer, 1 in 7, stroke, 1 in 20. So you're basically taking on our number one frailty. Right, human frailty. This is the killer.
That's right. That's why I'm terrified every day at work.
Right, the responsibility. It's all on your shoulders, Julian. So you've done a number of things, and I want to start off by, you've come to the right place. You've come to Cleveland. And the Cleveland Clinic, which is across the street, is the number one heart center in the world, isn't it?
That's what they say, yeah.
So you've come into the thick of it, and you know, taken on one of the big challenges. And there's two things I'd like to talk to you about to start off with. What's your background and how you got into the field? What did you do at the PhD level? What did you do at the postdoc level? And how did that allow you to step into a faculty position? And that second part, how did it allow you to step into a faculty position? You know, I've gotten a lot of emails asking, how does one go ahead, move forward with a career in science? And faculty positions are even more difficult than necessarily the industry, for example. It's very, very tough to get a faculty position. There's just so few of them, and they're so competitive. I'd like to ask you a little bit about how you managed to get through the process, not just because of the fact that you're really smart. What did you do? What was your advantage? Because there's a lot of smart people going for it, and you were very successful at doing it. I know your chairman, Walter Boron, who's also my business partner, he was at Yale for 30 years. He's really, really tough. And how you became his first candidate recruit is pretty impressive. So welcome to the show. And perhaps you could just start off by telling us a little bit about what you did at the PhD level.
All right. Yeah. So let's start with that. I think I have always been interested in how muscle works. I didn't really start out necessarily in cardiac muscle, but I was very interested in the way that muscle adapts to different environments, different stresses. For example, you know, starting out in skeletal muscle, you know, the most common thing that people look at is, you know, what's the effect of exercise, weight training on muscle development, things like that. And when I started doing my PhD work, I found some interesting applications, you know, with what's called muscle plasticity or how muscle changes with regards to different loading environments. And specifically, at the time, there was great interest in the space program and how effects, you know, how would space flight, which is in conditions of very low gravity, would affect the muscle development and muscle function. So that's kind of how I started out of my PhD level work, you know, looking really at the molecular mechanisms that govern, you know, how muscle contracts and generates force and things like that. So I did a lot of training studies looking what the effects of muscle hypertrophy is on force development in skeletal muscle and really how ground-based models of spaceflight, which is really a fancy way of saying that we suspended rodents upside down in a cage and looked at their at their muscle function. So that's kind of how I got my start in muscle. So it was quite fascinating.
Where did you do this work?
In Oregon State.
Okay.
On the West Coast. So when I was looking for a postdoc, I had an opportunity to continue the same line of work in skeletal muscle, looking at things like, you know, continuing the space flight work or looking at mechanisms of muscle atrophy in certain neurological diseases, which was interesting, but I felt like at that time I needed something different, and that's kind of how I stumbled onto cardiac muscle.
One heartbeat away.
Yeah, you know, basically, I when I first, you know, thought about, I started entertaining this idea of moving to the cardiac field, I wasn't tremendously interested in cardiac muscle because I didn't think, you know, it had the same adaptation potential that, you know, skeletal muscle does. But when I started reading about how complicated and how unique the heart is and how muscle functions within that environment, it was incredibly fascinated and it was incredibly complicated. So I felt, if I'm going to try and make a career out of this, I could probably spend a lifetime studying this and never be bored.
So how does the traditional muscle fiber and a heart muscle differ?
So first of all, the architecture of the heart is so unique. that if you think about, you know, most people when they think about how muscle in the heart works, how the cardiac muscle contracts, they kind of think that it's this homogeneous process that, you know, you just squeeze your fist and, you know, the blood goes oozing out of the ventricles. And when you start studying how the process actually takes place, you realize that it is so incredibly complex how the timing of all the different regions of the heart have to work together, how you know, the heart motion is really this ringing and unringing. It's, you know, it's kind of like squeezing a towel. And obviously we know that disease states affects, you know, different aspects of this mechanism. And really every disease has its own unique signature on how the heart works. So the cardiac muscle itself, you know, is technically made up of similar proteins, but the environment is completely different and the architecture is different. So those are the major differences.
How about the control?
Well, obviously, to simplify things, skeletal muscle is kind of an all or nothing mechanism where the muscles have to reach a particular threshold of activation and then they're active. With a cardiac muscle, obviously the way that the heart has to constantly change function and the heart rate level constantly changes, that it's mostly basically moving from one level to another, but obviously the heart never really turns off, at least not while it's functioning. So that the control is completely different as well.
How many cells, heart cells, muscle cells, do you need in a Petri dish for them to start beating?
For them to start beating.
What's this? Yeah. What's the smallest number you've seen?
One really? Myocyte. Yeah.
You're kidding. So it sits there alone going, jink, jink, jink.
Yeah. So the techniques that we use in the lab, we have the capability to really isolate the function of one myocyte or several myocytes stuck together and look at the nitty gritty of, you know, how these individual cells develop force and perhaps, you know, the kinetics of contraction and things like that. So things that are relevant to the in vivo function.
Really, that's pretty amazing demonstration, I suppose, in the lab is to have a single cell in a Petri dish and it's just sitting there contracting. How does it have all the internal feedback mechanisms that are required for human physiology? I mean, if you have the oxygen levels down low, does it start that one cell start pumping faster?
Well, I mean, obviously there are limitations to every technique when you take an isolated myocyte out of a whole heart. So there's different ways to study these cells and it really depends on what level of complexity you're interested in. So there are cells that have a functional calcium handling system when you can really electrically stimulate them, which is, you know, much more I would be in its natural environment. If you're interested in studying particular proteins that have to do with contraction and you want to control the calcium level to the cell, then you can treat them with certain detergents. And that allows you to look at the activation of the cell, different calcium environments, or in the absence or presence of different enzymes and so forth. So the latter is the majority of work that we do in our lab because we're really much more interested in the function of the motor proteins in the cardiac muscle.
Okay. And we did mention that we weren't, you know, between off air, that we weren't going to cover your material so much, or we're going to try and use other people's examples for obvious reasons.
That's right, yeah.
Just for, you know, if you've noticed, I've never spoken about my work on the show, and there's reasons for this. You know, it's a competitive environment. You don't necessarily want to share everything. So how about we, can you talk a little bit about, do you want to talk a little bit about what you're doing?
Sure.
Yeah, so. Okay, because that'd be really cool, but I don't want to push you into a corner.
No, it's fine. So basically, like I said, we look mostly at what we call myofilament proteins, which are the proteins that are responsible for the actual motor function of the cardiac units and how they develop force. we're interested in several particular proteins that are A, physiologically relevant because they either get phosphorylated and they increase or decrease their function in different conditions of cardiac stress, for example, or in a subset of proteins that are very susceptible to genetic mutations, which cause, you know, things like hypertrophic cardiomyopathy or dilated cardiomyopathy in patients. So these are the kind of things that cause people who otherwise seem healthy to, you know, drop dead and collapse at a young age. And then, you know, you go back and you look at what, you know, what the state of their cardiac muscle was, and you can identify some mutations in proteins. So things like that. So we look both at the physiological relevance of these proteins as well as the clinical relevance.
So your work basically in terms of, I'll start with the mutagenesis and understanding the various mutants that are causing people to drop dead. By understanding the changes in the specific genes, if you could find out what they are, correlate them to the dropping dead, you would be able to do personalized medicine, I suppose. And this is where having your own genome might actually save your life, right? And, you know, we had George Church on to talk about the Personal Genome Project, and a lot of people are reluctant because of the insurance plans, the insurance policies in the U.S. that if, you know, information got out, you wouldn't get insurance. I think, you know, right now that's not necessarily the case anymore because nobody can be denied. Although there's a lot of intricacies there, but imagine if you knew that you had a predisposition to just drop dead, if you could, you're like that lady in V in the TV show, right? Where, oh, by the way, in 15 years, you're going to drop dead. You can actually make those predictions if you've seen it before.
It's an interesting concept. I don't think it's so far-fetched. I don't know exactly the specificity, but we are aware of particular cases where we know that if someone develops or is born with a particular mutation, that the chances that they are going to end up in severe heart failure and require a transplant are quite high. So in theory, it would make sense to test, you know, particular individuals who are at risk and maybe put them on the transplant list sooner than later.
Really?
I don't know. I mean, I don't.
Is it gradual decay or is it like instant?
Well,
sorry,
I mean,
I'm laughing. This is kind of very morbid, but
yeah. So I guess those situations are a little more rare. But I have heard of them, and it seems like, you know, for some conditions, it might be a reasonable way to proceed.
And another thing you mentioned is phosphorylation. I like to translate this to my dad because he listens to the show. So phosphorylation is when you get a phosphate molecule attaching to your protein. And those are pretty heavy, right? So it's a heavy modification of a protein. The cells like to do this sort of thing to turn proteins on and off. It's kind of like a dip switch. So you're studying the effects of protein modification on their function and how this relates to disease as well, or heart damage?
Right. So physiologically, the phosphorylation, for example, when the heart rate has to increase, there's certain enzymes that are activated that cause certain proteins to be phosphorylated, and that increases or decreases function in a particular way that's gonna suit the new conditions. Mm-hmm. And we also know that in particular diseases, in heart failure, there are some proteins that tend to be dephosphorylated or phosphorylated, which contributes to the disease process itself, depending on what the role of that protein is. So as you said, the phosphorylation of a particular protein can really alter its function. So depending on what that status is, you can get a totally different functional profile.
I'm grabbing my chest here for the audience. I'm wincing. I've had heart surgery, so, and it was a fluke thing. So it's kind of, this is a hard interview for me. One of the hardest I've ever done. Knowing, I suppose I've got a sense for you know the biology of the cell, and you're telling me that the heart is just like any other biological system, that you've got proteins that can be regulated and modify the function of the organ in itself, is kind of really ringing home. So I apologize to the audience for my wincing and weirding out here. Yeah, as I said, it's always one heartbeat away. I keep repeating this. This is my little mantra here to sort of get me through this interview. maybe we should get the Audible ad out of the way, and that will be a kind of way to get a breather. and maybe we could talk a little bit more about how the proteins you're working on participate in the function of the heart exactly within the cell. And then we'll go on to the papers, because they're really great examples of some of the use of science to tackle major biological problems that kill millions of folk and cost tens or if not hundreds of billions of dollars. So before we get to that, though, I'd like to thank Audible.com for sponsoring Futures in Biotech. They're a leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For listeners of Futures in Biotech, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. And by the way, I'm going to get a little Steve Gibson in here and read you an email as part of the ad. I got an email from Brad Eric Hollister, and he was suggesting that, he was asking whether or not I've ever had or thought about getting Greg Bear on as a potential guest. And he's a novelist who writes great sci-fi. He's got books entitled Vitals or Blood Music. And while the one I found that I thought was interesting in the Audible library, it's called Darwin's Radio. And so this is Darwin's Radio by Greg Bear, narrated by George Geidel. And what it's about, I'll just read a little excerpt here, is in a cave in the high in the Alps, a renegade anthropologist discovers a frozen Neanderthal couple with a Homo sapiens baby. Meanwhile, in southern Russia, the United Nations, the Twit crew are telling me that they love Greg Bear. I'm getting distracted by pop-up windows. Okay, while in southern Russia, the United Nations investigation of a mysterious mass grave is cut short. One of the investigators, molecular biologist Kay Lang, returns home to the U.S. to learn that her theory of a human retrovirus has been verified with the discovery of Shiva. So these are viruses that sit in can sit in your DNA. And I think half of the human genome is actually retrovirus, right? And so this virus, which has slept in our DNA for hundreds of millions of years, is now waking up. Now, the reason why I picked Darwin's Radio is because it pairs very well with Futures in Biotech. And Futures in Biotech episode 53, David Hostler, the episode is called Project Genome 10K, Mapping Life's Greatest Journey. He talks about the makeup of the human genome and how by looking at the human genome of 10,000 mammals, you can and comparing them, you can look at what's conserved and find out what the original genome was of all these mammals. Mark Gerstein, episode 34, the show is called The Great Historical Document, The Human Genome. So pairing it up with Greg Bear's Darwin's Radio, which has the story of a virus that was a retrovirus that comes right back out. Well, it's a fun story. And go listen back to those two shows and then read the book, or vice versa. And then you're going to have it might weird you out as well. So, if you want to get Darwin's Radio for free, you head over to audible.com/biotech, sign up for the, I think it's the gold account, and you get a free audiobook. Now you get to try it. I mean, this is a trial service, so you can try it. If you don't like it, you just unsubscribe and you get to keep the free book. So it's a win-win situation. So I'd like to thank audible.com/biotech for sponsoring Futures in Biotech. So we can. Oh, by the way, in the email, Brad Eric Hollister, he also mentioned that he would like us to do a show just like we did on NMR, where we described how NMR works, or MRI, and do a show on X-ray crystallography. So we brought in Alex McPherson. He'll be on next week. He's one of the top educators in the field of X-ray crystallography. As a matter of fact, he taught Rod McKinnon, and another Nobel laureate, how to do X-ray crystallography, for which they won the Nobel Prize, right? So he taught two top scientists how to do the technique that won them the Nobel Prize. So next week on Futures in Biotech. So thanks for the idea, Brad. It's really appreciated. All right, so let's get back to the show. And we're listening to Futures in Biotech, and we've got Dr. Julian Stelzer talking about the biotech of the heart. So we were going to go and talk a little bit about the proteins that you're studying and how their modifications and mutations affect their activity. Could you describe a little bit how these proteins work?
Yeah, so basically, like I said, we're mostly interested in the motor proteins, and which mostly are responsible for how much force and how fast the contraction of the cardiac muscle, how that occurs. So the main proteins that are responsible for that are myosin, actin, and things like myosin light chains and other accessory proteins which bind myosin. Cardiac myosin binding protein C in particular is one of tremendous interest lately because it's been associated as the gene that's has the highest rate of mutations of the genetic mutations we discussed earlier. So those are basically the most of the proteins that we study in the lab on a regular basis.
And these form a molecular machine?
Yeah, so you know, basically this you can think of these proteins as cycling along each other and generating, you know, these myosin molecules kind of bind to actin, and they kind of skate along actin and they pull themselves along, and that's how the muscles shorten and contract.
Let me see. Can you explain that again? I'm sorry, I'm gonna have to listen back. I'm still wincing. So the you've got two fibers and an actin molecule zipping back and forth.
Yeah, so they're thin filaments and thick filaments. So the thick filament is the myosin and its accessory proteins, and the actin is the thin filament. And when these myosin molecules bind to actin, they bind tightly and they pull themselves along the molecule, and that's how you generate force.
Sort of like my fingers here going back and
basically,
forth.
Basically, you can think of it as a rowboat. You know how the kind of the boat slides along the water, and these oars are kind of like the binding of the myosins to the actins.
And you can control these.
You can control the rate and how many myosin molecules are binding to actin, which will control the force. Now, obviously, there's other mechanisms. A lot of this is driven by how much calcium is in the system, and that comes from other components, which we're not really talking about today, which also are largely responsible to how much force can be produced and how fast the force is produced as well.
And do you think drugs or genetic modification can be used to control in a state of disease?
Yeah, so some of the more novel techniques, and we'll get to one of them today, is to try and control how fast this process takes place between the activation of the myosins and actins together and how much force can be generated. And there are some benefits to that, in particular in heart failure, and that are largely to do with the fact that you're not interfering necessarily with the calcium homeostasis of the cell, which we know is one of the main culprits in what really ends up causing a lot of damage, which is cardiac arrhythmias.
How about we tackle the first paper? Do you want to talk about Shen first? Go to Rosenbaum.
Yeah, it's a good segue to that.
Right. Well, it's the premise of the paper suggests what? I'll let you ask that one.
So like I said before, so this particular drug that we'll be talking about is in development now. I think it's in clinical trials, but the idea is somewhat different than what's been out there in the past, because for particular situations where the cardiac output is insufficient and causes perhaps low blood pressure and low peripheral performance, generally what's been prescribed is what's what we call ionotropes, which increase the force and the rate of cardiac muscle contraction, which the payoff is that you have increased cardiac function and cardiac output. The down part of that is that you're necessarily activating some sort of cyclic AMP type system, which calcium is a major component of, and you are now dysregulating potentially the calcium homeostasis as well as increasing the oxygen demand on the system. So you're generating more energy expenditure, which is not always good in heart failure.
So you're controlling calcium, but and the side effect is to control cell signaling in the cell, which then has a feedback loop into the metabolism of the cell. Sounds pretty tricky.
Right, absolutely.
Not a good thing, right? Or sometimes a good thing.
Right, so especially because a lot of these drugs will tend to activate both sides of the coin. They will tend to generate more force and faster contraction. But also they may cause long-term desensitization. So if you use these therapies for a prolonged amount of time, you may top out your effect or need more drug to generate the same effect.
So let's read the title. Okay, so this is for the people that enjoy like hardcore biotech. It's improvement of cardiac function by a cardiac myosin activator in conscious dogs with cytosolic heart failure.
Systolic.
Did I read that correctly?
I knew I didn't read it right.
All right. I should. That's why we haven't touched the heart in fib yet. So, okay. So, improvement of cardiac function by a cardiac myosin activator in conscious dogs with systolic heart failure. All right. let's turn to page one, to the abstract. So, how do you want to break this down? Do you want to go over the abstract material and sort of go through the paper and describe their major finding?
Yeah, I guess we can just go over the major findings and kind of how they did the experiment. Like we said, some of the pieces are not readily available or obvious because this is a clinical drug. So I think the exact mechanism of how this may be working is, you know, not necessarily public knowledge yet. So we can go through the data and then we can take it for what it is. And I think the idea itself is novel. So, you know, this could be a good future direction for research.
Cool. And we could possibly have the author on, the senior author on to talk about it.
Sure.
You know, let me point out again to the audience that here's a drug that could help save one of those 300,000 lives, right? It's 300,000 lives a year that die. At a cost of $37 billion to society. Right, so this is a major, major problem. And, you know, sometimes a simple drug which can improve outcome can, you know, even if it saved half those people, you're talking about saving 150,000 lives a year, which is enormous, which is incredible. You know, think about the level of death in war and think about what you can do as a scientist to get a drug out and potentially, you know, counteract the numbers of deaths the past, you know, three wars and just, you know, reverse that for good. I hate to be an ideologue, I suppose. you got to, you know, find the strength to do some of these experiments, and it takes an enormous amount of work. So this drug is called omecamtiv.
That's right.
Mecarbil. Yeah. Mecarbil. They couldn't come out with a fancy name, like a simple name.
Yeah, so maybe, you know, if this drug does go through, we might have to petition to change its name. You can't say that very fast.
Heart smooth.
By the way, Mark, what you just talked about now, I think I had the opportunity to spend some time, you know, in a real OR because I was interested in, you know, human heart failure, and obviously there's no other way to get to really understand human disease, but to study the human tissue itself. So I was fortunate enough to have a collaboration where with some cardiothoracic surgeons who were doing cardiac transplants. And, you know, we were able to get some of the explanted hearts that were being harvested and replaced with new hearts. And you talked about the strength to carry out these experiments. I think that, you know, that definitely helped me understand how important this work is and why it's worth doing. And the other thing that it really brings home is that, you know, that not only is this really complicated, that, you know, the effects of long-term heart failure are really devastating. you know, when you look at what comes out of the person when they're being transplanted, you can't really believe that this thing was even pumping blood. It's pretty impressive. So like you said, this is a big deal, and this is a huge problem. So these drugs are if they work, they could be really great.
Well, I sat in an ER, not an ER, sorry, in a cardiac step down, and I was there for a week, and the patient across the hall had a heart transplant. And after 5 or 6 days, he and I were walking up and down the halls together. And this lady who was in the room beside me had an artificial heart. And while this seems like, you know, necessarily, it's amazing, right? But it's not necessarily the be-all, end-all. If you know, you can get a drug that can just... And sort of an understanding of the function of the heart down to the molecular level, where you can make a prediction as to where the condition of the heart really is and where it's going, and then tailor some, you know, personal cocktails of drugs that will stabilize that heart and add 20 years without having to do the surgery. You know, you might die of a car accident first before the end of that. So it will certainly push back the problem of the heart. I hate to joke about it, but so that's pretty. It's pretty cool. And so you were there taking a human heart out into, so that you could use some of the material for your experiments.
Yeah, so we were interested in, you know, understanding what really happens to these hearts after long-term heart failure. And, you know, it's so obviously the long-term goal of doing something like that is to develop potential therapeutic drugs to target those particular areas. But there's obviously not a lot of data on the actual human heart for obvious reasons. So, you know, having the opportunity to participate in a study like that really helped me understand, you know, what are the things that really need to be done.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about omecamtiv. I can't even pronounce it. Formerly CK-1827-452.
Yeah, can't win with either one of those names. okay, so I think we touched a bit about the background already. What's the novelty and the advantage, perhaps, of going in this approach as opposed to the traditional ionotrope type of thing? So the major advantage, as addressed by the authors, is that you can get increased function without necessarily interfering with calcium processes. And another big advantage is that you don't increase the energy expenditure, and that's obviously very important to a failing heart that is already struggling to cope with its normal duties. So those are the two biggest benefits that are kind of outlined in this paper. And that's basically what's said in the abstract. Now, the major finding is, or perhaps the interesting mechanism of action, which is also unique to this drug to date, is that it doesn't necessarily increase the rate of contraction. It tends to prolong the period of systolic ejection. So that would... So increasing the period of systolic ejection obviously would be beneficial for ejecting more blood with every heartbeat.
So it slows down the release,
right,
of the contraction.
Right. So basically the way the heart works is it develops pressure until, you know, when the pressure is overcome, the valve opens and the blood gets ejected. Now that obviously the period when that valve is open and the blood is able to eject, you know, has to be timed correctly with the heart rate and all the other processes. So if we're able to prolong that ejection phase, then we can squeeze more of the blood out. And if it doesn't cost the heart any more energy, then that's a win-win.
That's amazing. So how do they find the drug?
How do they find the drug? So I'm guessing this is a small molecule. The structure or exactly how they stumbled onto the idea, you know, I don't really know the history, but I think it took extensive testing to find this particular molecule that will have the desired effect without influencing all those other things we talked about earlier that might be beneficial in the short term, but might be detrimental in the long term. So I'm guessing they had to test several compounds until they finally settled on this one, which had, you know, the best effects that they wanted.
Let's go through some of the I'm flipping through the paper here. Apologies, I'm not looking at the camera. This is how do you want to tackle this?
So let's try and explain this heart failure model first of all, is a little bit confusing because I think you had to read some of their previous papers to understand what was going on here.
That's why you're here.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm going to do this justice, but I'll do my best. So
that's okay.
So basically, they had these dogs, and dog and pig are common models that people use to mimic human heart function. And basically, what they wanted to do was to induce some sort of damage. So they induce several ways of damage that are going to try and mimic the human heart failure condition, and then they treated these animals with their drug in a dose-dependent fashion for, I believe, up to 72 hours of using infusion. So there's a couple models here. One of them is an infarction model, and the other one is a model which is aortic banding, which is designed to create hypertrophy in the ventricle, mm-hmm. which is one of the hallmarks of what happens to the heart when it begins to fail. And then they compounded those effects by ventricular pacing, which is really pacing the heart out of rhythm. So the heart is normally paced to the atria, so they're pacing the cardiac muscle through the ventricle, exacerbating the effects of the infarction in the aortic banding model.
Okay, let me translate that into English. I understand infarction. So they basically put a clot, sort of like a...
So they tied a coronary vessel, right? And that causes some of the cardiac tissue to become ischemic. And it's
just like a arterial sclerosis, right? Like a clot in the...
No, it's not a clot. It's literally...
tied it, but that imitates a clot.
The important thing is that the end result is that you have basically a piece of scarred tissue that essentially is no longer contracting within the heart itself.
And what was the other method?
So the other method was to tie off an aortic they call it aortic stenosis. Basically, what you're trying to induce is pressure overload hypertrophy. So you're causing the ventricular wall to hypertrophy.
Okay.
In a nutshell, they just wanted to really cause some long-term heart dysfunction to try and mimic an end-stage heart patient the best they could.
Sure. And they use dogs because they're the right size. They're easy to work with in the ER.
Well, I mean, if you look at the basal heart rate, it's relatively close to what a human might be, at least a dog that size. And, there are some advantages to using dogs over pigs, for example, because they're able to train them to, be more or to lay still while they're trying to make some of the more intricate measurements so it doesn't interfere. But usually those are the two biggest animal models that are mostly representative of perhaps the human heart function.
And they do this in conscious dogs?
So obviously the surgeries are done under anesthesias, but they implant several devices that are able to monitor cardiac function. And basically they're able to monitor. So then they're able to study these animals in a conscious state while these instruments are implanted in the animal.
Mm-hmm. So they've now replicated long-term heart failure.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there are differences to different types of heart failure, different animal models versus others. But I think generally speaking, they produce some of the hallmarks of heart failure, including hypertrophy and changes in diastolic pressure and so forth.
Okay, I'm looking. So the effects of omecamtiv mecarbil 24 hours after infusion in conscious dogs with LVH, which is
left ventricular hypertrophy. So this is tying off a blood vessel to increase the pressure
in the presence of SHF.
So the SHF is what they induced they call that systolic heart failure, and they induce that with their ventricular pacing model, essentially to exacerbate the regular heart failure they induced in the dogs to start with.
And it says the improved cardiac performance was accompanied by a decrease in heart rate and LV and diastolic pressure, whereas the MVO2 remained unchanged. So the molecular oxygen was unchanged?
Right. So the one of the biggest things that they tried to put across with this drug is that really that you can get these beneficial effects in cardiac muscle function and heart function without increasing the energy cost of these processes. So so they view this as one of the best benefits of this drug.
That's amazing. So how long is this drug, how far is this drug away from clinical trials? They've got it working in dogs.
So I believe
is it a well-known drug in terms of tox?
So I believe it's it's currently in clinical trials. I believe it's phase two. I think this might be one of the first real studies that have been published. A lot of this stuff has been published either in abstract form or presentations and meetings. So I think there's a lot of the human stuff is still out there being tested right now. But based on this study, it looks like it does show some promise.
That's pretty amazing. So this is a great example. So again, if people want to go look at the abstract, they can go to PubMed, they can Google PubMed, and they can look at the article that's entitled Improvement of Cardiac Function by Cardiac Myosin Activator in Conscious Dogs with Systolic Heart Failure. We can put a link to that in the show notes. I think that'd be good. By Stephen F. Vatner. Do you want to, is like, did I think I get it. Sorry. This is why I've had a hard time with the cardiac stuff, man. So, but it's really cool because the implications is if you can make a drug that can improve heart function without, you know, having any kind of other physiological effects on the heart, seems outstanding because you're going to save, as I said, 150,000 lives plus a year. Maybe that's just in the US alone, right? So potentially a million people a year you'd be saving. Do you want to talk a little bit about the second paper?
Sure. So I think as a caveat, we should obviously mention that, one of the things that you learn quite quickly when you start looking at clinical data is that often patients are taking, you know, multiple drugs at the same time, often having opposite effects on heart function. So it's animal studies are much more controlled in that way that you can see, you know, the effect you might envision from your drug more readily. Whereas in human patients, the treatment with the same drug might not elicit as a powerful response depending on what, you know, the patient is taking at the same time. So I think as in terms of proof of concept, this is very nice. But obviously we have to wait for the human studies to come out before sure. We see it, how effective the drug is. So we can talk about the second paper. I thought we would, we talked a little bit about myosin, the motor function and how you can directly target it. So obviously every heart failure model is different. You can't, you know, treat a heart failure patient with the same drug depending on what, you know, what the need is. So do you want to introduce the second paper?
Sure. Well, I like when you emailed it to me, at 11:30 last night, I thought it was really cool. And I thought it was cool because, well, even though I don't think this is going to hit the market anytime soon, I think it's pretty wild that instead of doing heart surgery, you can just give a person a virus and that goes into their heart and it fixes their heart. Right. So sort of gene therapy attacking the heart. If I understood the paper correctly, I mean,
one of the reasons why this is interesting to look at, just because it's a completely different approach and it actually goes at the problem from the opposite end of the first paper. Now, obviously in this particular paper, they were using adenovirus constructs and usually those are, thought to have a few more inflammatory issues that might not make him the best the best target for human gene therapy. But the idea was really to test, you know, if this can be done in an animal model to see, again, more of a, as a proof of concept that this really is a good gene to target for this particular heart failure.
Sure. Let me read the title. Let me give it a try because this is kind of funny. People are, you know, I know some people can be laughing. Targeted CIRCA2A gene expression identifies molecular mechanism therapeutic target for
arrhythmogenic.
Yeah. Arrhythmogenic cardiac alternins. So I read this to my brother-in-law. He was like, yeah. I'm sure you'll figure it out too. So I tried. Targeted CIRCA2A gene expression identifies molecular mechanism and therapeutic target for arrhythmogenic cardiac alternins. People should, if they go to PubMed, right, just Google PubMed go, and then enter David S. Rosenbaum, R-O-S-E-N-B-A-U-M. And they'll find it. It came out in 2009, right? So, you want to give a brief?
Let's give a brief outline of what the problem is before we dive into the paper.
Sure.
So, and we talked a little bit more about, you know, before about what the end result is and how, you know, calcium affects muscle contraction, but you know, the whole cascade where calcium is constantly being introduced and taken out of the cells to drive contraction and slow it down is really governed by a very complex network of calcium handling proteins. So just briefly to give a very, very small overview, the major players are in the calcium handling cascade is a protein called ryanodine, which is responsible for releasing the calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum where it's stored. And then that calcium...
Okay, wait. Sarcoplasmic reticulum is a compartment within the cell that represents the endoplasmic reticulum, right, of the regular cell. So it's this place where calcium is stored inside the cell and can get spat out by the cell. So sarcoplasmic...
Right.
Okay, cool.
So because muscle contraction is really driven by calcium, it's kind of the beginning of the cascade. So the amount of calcium that's available to the cells has to be very tightly regulated because too much calcium can lead to arrhythmias and too little calcium can lead to a deficit in force generation. So ryanodine is really how the calcium is released into the cytosol and becomes available to the myofilaments, which you talked about earlier. And then that calcium has to be sequestered back into the SR. And that is done through the protein, which is the target of this study, which is CIRCA2A. And that protein is also inhibited by a protein called phospholamban, when it's in its dephosphorylated form, and it promotes CIRCA activity when it's phosphorylated. So again, okay,
let me break this down. So CIRCA2A is a pump that pumps calcium back into the cell.
Right.
And then that one, CIRCA2A, is regulated by a phosphatase. Now, a phosphatase is an enzyme that removes that little phosphate group that's attached to proteins. Henceforth, there's like a dip switch mechanism that regulates the pump that's sucking calcium back into the cell.
Right. So when the heart rate increases or in conditions of cardiac stress, there needs to be more calcium released into the system, and that calcium has to be taken out faster to stay so the heart stays in rhythm. So in a nutshell, that's the cascade. And now in heart failure, it is known that certain aspects of this cascade could be altered. Primarily that the ryanodine receptor, which is responsible for releasing the calcium into the cell, becomes dysregulated and tends to release more calcium than necessary. They call that a ryanodine leak. And then there's also a dysregulation in the mechanism that reuptakes the calcium back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. The number of CIRCA receptors decreases, and the protein that's kind of the CIRCA gatekeeper, the phospholamban, also tends to stay in its inhibitory form, that way not allowing the calcium to be reuptake as much. Sorry.
Taken up. Is there a word? Reuptake.
reuptaken. I don't know if that's a word. Let's just say
that is a word. We make up words in bio. So
it's okay.
Plenty of words. So let me, I just had an epiphany, I think. So the sarcoplasmic reticulum, that compartment that holds the calcium, is not ejecting the calcium outside the cell, but within the rest of the cell. So it's like having a sponge inside a cell that holds calcium, and then it's squeezing it, letting the calcium out, and then got little channels that allow it to suck back into that sarcoplasmic reticulum. But all the calcium stays within the cell. And that Correct. Calcium is what drives the myosin motors, the molecular machines that contract and release.
Correct.
Oh, okay. This is cool. I took plant phys. Is it apparent
that plants do this also? That's great.
No. I took my undergraduate requirement in physiology was accomplished by doing plant physiology. Oh, but I did some plant biotech. Yeah, right. So that's another reason why I've avoided this. So we've got it. Is it a channel that's the circuit way?
It's a pump.
It's a regulated pump. Okay, and you need this pump to clear out the calcium so that the heart can stay in rhythm.
Right.
And what did these guys do? How did they change the function of this pump to test whether or not it could be used or modified?
So basically what they tried to do is increase the expression of circa, and the effect of that is going to be that you can reuptake more calcium back into the cell. So we know that having an abundance of calcium or cytosolic calcium is one of the triggers for arrhythmias, which is really at the end of the day what ends up doing most people in these conditions. So what they were able to do is show that that they can increase this expression homogeneously,
or make more of it. To increase expression means to make more of the protein. They can engineer,
right?
So
the other thing that that they do mention in the paper, and it's also important to note that just making more of this is not going to help if you're not actually getting it to the right spots in the heart. We said that the expression of these proteins and their function is heterogeneous in the heart. That means that you may have more protein or less protein in different regions, and the kinetics of those proteins may work differently. So one of the things they were able to accomplish is that they were able to express these proteins in a homogeneous way, so they're increased in the correct orientation.
Wow. So they used adenovirus, which is it's a virus that's pretty easy. It's a common virus that we can engineer in the lab, that you can just pop a gene in, pop a gene out. So they put circa 2A under the control of a promoter. Is it a heart-based promoter? Is that how they, or did... They actually attached GFP, a green fluorescent protein, so they could track
I think that's how they were able to visualize the expression.
So they did this in guinea pig hearts. So they infected guinea pig hearts, or did they infect a guinea pig and the guinea pig hearts were targeted because of the promoter?
No, I think they were able to actually... I think they got local expression by really inserting these injections, right into the blood vessels or into the cord, I believe right into the ventricle.
It says here, cytomegalovirus-driven expression cassette. So they used a uber viral promoter switch to make the protein. So they really cranked up the circuit 2A.
Right. So actually they show that the expression or the increased expression they got was not much greater than 30 or 40%, but this was enough to really show that they're able to get the calcium back into the cell. And what they were really interested in doing is seeing what one of the main things that they say causes these arrhythmias is that there is when the heart rate exceeds the capability of the cardiac myocyte to cycle calcium. So this typically happens at high workloads, which are very high heart rates. So I think they show a couple figures where they're able to really control these effects of the calcium reuptake up to very, very high heart rates, which is important physiologically.
So they basically made a super heart. a heart that could take up calcium as fast as needed, even an increased heart rate that was beyond the amount of uptake, traditional uptake.
Right. And then,
Go ahead.
What did you say?
Is this only in disease states that the heart can't handle the calcium reuptake?
So that's one of the, that's one of the mechanisms by which, when the expression levels of these proteins that are responsible for releasing the calcium and reuptaking it are disrupted, then you're much more susceptible to an arrhythmia, especially at higher heart rates when the speed of the process has to go up a lot. So I think what they were able to show that they are able to specifically target this particular pathway without interfering with other electrophysiology parameters that could be important.
So Rosenbaum basically showed that this protein, if possibly targeted with a drug that could activate it, make it more, an agonist, make it stronger, could actually be a valuable drug target. That if you improve calcium reuptake through CIRCA2A, you're going to improve the heart's ability to withstand higher blood pressure and heart rate.
Well, yeah. So if you were able to increase the expression of this protein, you will be able to clear cytosolic calcium more efficiently. And that would remove one of the main culprits of arrhythmia.
So you do it that way. So you would say going with the gene therapy in the heart would be the better way to go than to give with to go with a pharmacological drug. I'm just asking. I don't know either way.
I don't really know. I think this particular target is. I think they're attempting it both ways, and also because of the potential inflammatory effects of this particular virus. I think it's also being developed in adeno-associated virus or AAV, which are known to be less toxic in humans. Mm-hmm. So I believe they're also trying to develop a drug. Similar to the first drug we talked about that could be either infused or taken orally.
So a drug you'd be on for life, is the gene expression maintained? Do you think, but with some of these gene therapy approaches, do you think the expression could be maintained for 30 years?
I don't know. Well, this particular study, maybe not, but I think they have shown that with other virus deliveries that you get stable expression for years. So,
wow.
So it is a viable approach.
Okay. Well, I think it's pretty amazing. I think it's really amazing. I think these are two really good examples, right, of the development of a novel drug that can really improve physiological outcome and function of the heart, and alternatively using gene therapy. And they did it on Chinese hamster hearts. What was that? Is that correct? Yeah. But it worked. I mean, they were able to create a virus, engineer a virus that could go into the heart, or even if they infused it into the heart, was able to improve outcome. That's amazing. So there may come a day where rather than have, a new heart valve put in, you'd be able to just get a syringe and get infused with a virus, right? Biotech of the heart.
That's right. So I think that could be a direction that the field is heading.
Cool, because that really hurt. I'm pointing my chest here. It really hurts. I got 5 weeks of, my brother came over to the house and cracked a joke, and I was laughing, and my sternum was all falling apart. That little baby grabbed my son was born the same 2 days after. He's grabbing all my little zipper. It's really hardcore. I'm losing listeners right now as I speak.
Mark, you're scaring the audience.
Hey, so no, this is why it's amazing. It's important. This is really, really important work, and I really appreciate you coming on to give us some examples of some of the, and. Some of this work, and I really appreciate the audience hanging through till the end, those that did, because it was really hardcore, but it's a first look for Futures in Biotech into the biotechnology of the heart. So I really thank you for coming on. And so what we'll do is we'll try and contact some of these top-notch guys and get them to talk about their work and how they came across – some of these new approaches and what they're doing and how it's going. It'd be really great to have you co-host some of those shows. And we'll, you know, maybe you could help, you know, bring it down from their level to your level, and then I can take it from your level and bring. Although yeah, you're up at their level, you're just younger. That's all.
So we also have to say that, you know, neither you or I have any stock or any interest in these companies per se. So whatever we're promoting here today is strictly for the science.
Yeah, what companies produce these? Well, this is published in the journal Circulation. The paper one by Shen et al. Is in Circulation, Heart Failure. We'll provide a link. And the other one was in Circulation, Arrhythmia, and Electrophysiology. And that's by Cutler et al., 2009. The other one was 2010. So, we didn't even mention the companies. I don't know. And I don't think we have to worry about it. This is editorial perspective. We're asking
for
your opinion.
That's right.
Awesome. So, more heart to come, more biotech of the heart. As I said, one heartbeat away, right, from death. So, this is, if you're going to do some work in the area of biotech, you could have a serious impact. And it's the number one human frailty, right? It kills the most people. It's heart disease, 1 in 5. So thanks a lot for coming on, Julian.
All right, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me.
I'd like to also thank Burke McQuinn for handling the audio video boards today and the recordings. Thank you, Burke. I'd also like to welcome our new producer, Tony Wang, who has been an editor for several years at This Week in Tech. He's taking on some additional responsibilities, and one of them is going to be producing Futures in Biotech. So he's going to be doing a lot of the work over at Petaluma to help the show out. So welcome on board, Tony, and appreciate you helping out with the show. I'd also like to thank the team that made this possible, Leo Laporte, Dane Golden, Eric Lanigan, Frederic Louis, and the rest of the team in Petaluma, California. Lastly, I'd like to thank Phil Peltier and Will Hall for the opening and closing themes. If you have any comments or suggestions, you can reach me at futuresinbiotech.com. That's futuresinbiotech.com. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Peltier.